welcome to episode number 241 of the Apologue Podcast. I am your host, Simon Head. I know I screwed up last week by calling last week's episode 241, but it was actually 240. So this episode is actually 241. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming in every week, week after week, tuning in into the show. It's very, very helpful. Thank you so much. Thanks, everybody, for tuning into the show week after week. It's very, very, very kind of you. Thank you so much. If you're on Amazon and you like to shop on Amazon, you can support the show by going to apologue.ca/Amazon or apologue.ca/USAmazon. You can do it the old-fashioned way, too, by going to apologue.ca and click on those banners located on the right side. Locate your country, and every time you shop on Amazon, use those links. Bookmark them. Use them, shop, and help the show out. Costs you no extra money, and it's awesome. I'd like to thank all the people helping me out on Patreon. You too can become a patron by going to patreon.com/apologue. You can pledge as much or as little as you want on a monthly basis to help with hosting and gas fees, and you can cancel at any time. Go to the shop by going to apologue.ca/shop, buy a t-shirt. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes. Give it 5 stars, please. Like the show on Facebook by going to facebook.com/apologuepod. Follow me on Twitter at SimonHead666. Today on the show, I have Nick Woods from the band Direct Hit. Direct Hit are a band from Wisconsin, Milwaukee, actually. They started in 2007, and they have some great tunes. They just put a record out last year, and they're actually playing Blackout Fest, which is 2 weeks ago. I had Jamie Mittendorf from Blackout Fest to talk about the Blackout Fest, and Direct Hit are playing this. October 18th and 19th, they'll be coming up to Canada. They're actually going to be at the Hard Luck Bar on September 16th. I hope you enjoy one of these songs I'm going to play right now. The album's called Crown of Nothing, and the song's called Welcome to Heaven. And Marble Mouth Simon, we'll get through this.
So welcome to heaven, just a state of dumb contentment, sitting all alone in blackness, floating on a cognizant cloud of ashes. All we are in this bitter alternative, where our spirit comes back, teaches lessons to those who live on and on and on and on. In a second world, so welcome to heaven.
Into the ball, not the first time you've brought him to tears. So welcome to heaven, just a state of dumb contentment, peeling back small and here in iron tongue, a condescent cloud, ash among your vengeance, cause here, yeah, it's all you've got, just your spirit living on, just to teach him about your own loss, because you know your ethics is hell and it doesn't stop. Eyes out, rolling up into the back of your vengeful soul, just staring straight deep in the net. He doesn't try to apologize.
Once again, that is Direct Hit. The album is called Crown of Nothing. The song is called Welcome to Heaven. They are on tour. They're coming up to Toronto on the 16th of September. They're also playing Blackout Fest October 18th and 19th. They're co-headlining with the band Seaway. Here they are, this is the toughest intro I've had to do in a long time. I don't know what it is. Here is Nick Woods from the band Direct Hit, and it's on the Apple Podcast. How are you? Good to meet you.
Yeah, I'm good. Nice talking to you, man. I'm sorry that it took so long to link up. It's just been a really busy couple of weeks.
No, I bet, man. Touring and just living the life of a musician is never...
It's more being able to live the life of a musician while also trying to be a decent husband and dad and hold down a job. And I got a club now too that I run. And so it's been a busy year.
I bet.
For sure, put it mildly.
Yeah. Being a dad on tour. I'm a dad too. I have two kids, but I've been on tour with like a 3-year-old at one point and it's,
oh, wild, man. Yeah, mine's 3.5.
So, it's tough, right?
Yeah, dude, to put it mildly, I think. So, how old are your kids now?
They're 12 and 16.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Did you say that you brought them on tour?
No. when I was touring, it was like, I just got this band together, and then we had, you know, and I had kids and stuff, and it was sort of like trying to balance being a musician and being a dad. I kind of just chose being a dad more of being a musician. That was my, you know what I mean?
It's tough to balance. It's way more important than any bullshit punk rock thing that anybody does. Just taking care of your kids and making sure that they feel great and they're responsible people just like you and I are. So,
yeah. I mean, being a dad on tour, there's a lot of saving graces in this day and age because you have FaceTime, you have, a video component to your thing, you know, which is very, very good. When I toured like the early 2000s, it was like nothing. I had phone cards that I had for a cell phone. It was $2 or €2 a minute to try to, and it cost me so much money just to stay connected.
I can't imagine at all. I wouldn't be able to do it without all this stuff for sure.
Yeah.
It would just be too weird being that disconnected from everything back at home. So I guess, I suppose in the early 2000s, there was more money. So I guess that's it dried up pretty quick right around then though, I think.
Yeah, so, I agree. Well, I sort of hit it just at when the music industry died. So yeah. I was having a tough time. And plus, I was in a band called Foursquare, and we were on a label called Bad Taste Records out of Sweden.
Oh, cool.
And awesome. Yeah, so we had a good thing going, and it was really tough. Like, I wish that type of thing would happen 20 years earlier or 10 years earlier at least, so I could sort of do it and not feel like I'm letting anybody down. And, I had a band, we put some records out, we did some touring, but it's so goddamn tough. It's so tough. And touring, you know, just even today, you know, we have nicer roads, we have maybe better sound systems and a better environment to tour in, but it's still hard. You know, you gotta, that's what you have to do.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I always look at it as a friend of mine liked to talk about how it's not possible to not follow your dreams and be a happy person still. Like you have to figure out a way to do it in one way or another, or else you end up feeling like a total loser regardless, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And so like I'd always look at it as I want my kid to be able to see somebody who's important to her being able to figure out how to do what they want to do and what makes them feel good and important, and not be a total waste because of it, you know? And so I like to think that when she watches me on stage or when she hears a record of mine or a song that I wrote or something like that, it gives her a sense that she can do whatever she wants to do too, if she works hard enough and if she puts enough thought into it. That's sort of how I justify climbing in a van for weeks on end and calling her on FaceTime instead of being home for all of that time. So,
yeah, no, I totally appreciate that. Yeah. Because you're right. Like as a person that makes art, it's part of you and it's a part of your life to what fulfills you as a person.
Mm-hmm.
But also absolutely. So do children, and so does, yeah. You know, so does being on
it's
the
never other. Just one thing though, man. Like I sort of get that. So Direct Hit kind of makes all this music that ends up like being part of a bigger story or something like that. And we spend a lot of time on video, and I used to talk a lot more than I do now. I think there's other people that should get a turn at this point besides me. to say stuff. But I never, even with music, I never looked at it as its own kind of one thing that I was interested in. And it's the same thing with like you said, fulfilling yourself. I don't see music as the only thing that I need to be fulfilled. You know, there's a lot more to life than just being in a van and playing tunes. And, even though that's a really important part of my life and I wouldn't give it up for anything. I think there's other important stuff back here that matters just as much to me as that, you know?
Yeah. And balance.
One thing is music is, I mean, music has never asked me for anything.
Yeah.
It's brought a lot of joy to me. And I like to think that I brought a lot of joy to other people with the music that I've made. And so it's very important to me, but there's other stuff that's just as important here too. So
yeah, I hear you. And balance is important. What I was going to say, like balance, having perspective of being in a band and being on tour and then going back to a job or coming home and enjoying that. And it gives a lot of perspective in touring. And a lot of dads do that. They'll tour for a week and come home for like 2 weeks, like Teenage mm-hmm. Bottle Rocket. They don't tour any more than a week or 2 weeks at a time now.
I don't see a lot of, or a whole lot of bands that are going out, at least on our level, unless they're like, you know, Beyonce or Metallica or something like that. I don't see a whole lot of groups that'll go out for weeks and weeks on end. You know, I think Pairs is probably like the only like exception to that rule now.
Yeah.
At this point, I feel like that band could go out for like years at a time, you know, and figure out a way to still make it work. But yeah, I mean, we try to do about 10 weeks of tour in a year, and we never really go out for longer than, I think 3 weeks is probably the maximum we've gone out at a time over the last few years. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. I love being on tour, but it's really difficult. Especially if you have a family at home, leaving them behind for that long. I mean, there's ways to do it with work and things like that. I've worked a remote job for a while and, but yeah, I mean, disconnecting from your home life is a difficult thing to do for that length of time. I feel like it's much easier if you break it up into little pieces.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And so you guys were, it sounds like you were out west. Yeah. Cause I think when we first connected, you were in Portland and mm-hmm. then, and then you were in Chicago. What was mm-hmm. what was in between on this trip?
So, actually it was Portland, Maine, as a matter of
fact. Oh, Maine. Oh, you're on the other side.
No, it's okay. Everybody seems to confuse it when I mentioned that.
Yeah.
Maine was the last state that we had, well, at least I had to visit in the lower 48. My last group I played, between this band that I'm in now and my last band, I think I've done all 48 states in the continental U.S. And I think after that, when I was in, we were in Chicago yesterday for 350 Fest, which is like a big brewery festival, right outside Chicago. And both of those were just kind of weekend trips. You know, it wasn't like we drove all the way out to Maine and then drove all the way back and played shows all the way home. So
yeah,
we're just making it out to the East Coast for a couple of weeks now is a tough thing for us to do. Oh, yeah. I think.
Well, you're pretty much in the middle of America. I mean, not middle, but you're close enough to sort of go a little west or go a little east or go a little south and still have stuff. Like being in Canada, we don't get that privilege, you know.
For yeah, for real. I know what it's like driving between Vancouver and Calgary or something like that. Yeah. It's like gorgeous every single place you go, but it's gorgeous in the isolation in a lot of ways, I think. We were talking to Sarah about that the other day. Like we'd never thought about traveling up to Newfoundland to play ever. And I asked if we could just be like, yeah, can we just like string like five dates along or something like that? And she was like, yeah, if you feel like driving for 31 hours and seeing nothing along the way.
And take a ferry, a 2-day ferry or something like that.
Yeah, it's nuts. I mean, I think we're lucky just east of the Mississippi, everything is relatively close, you know, so you can drive for 4 or 5 hours at a time and find a city to play along the way. Going west, though, is a little bit different. Yeah. It's tough to string dates along to get all the way out west. That's a 3-week trip if you're in a van. Most of the time, like, we just almost treat the West Coast as like going on a vacation or something like that. It's way easier to climb on a plane and then just climb off and fly back home or something like that, rent a van while we're out there or something. So we're in a fortunate enough position where we can do stuff like that. It would be a lot rougher for us getting out to California if we couldn't do that. So
yeah, I've done that drive a lot, actually. Chicago to through Vegas and then through, well, Salt Lake City, Vegas, and then to like down to like San Diego and stuff. It's like, yeah, there's a lot of desert. There's a lot of crazy. There's not too many shows.
Yeah.
I used to tour a lot in the mid-90s with a band called SNFU. And
they, oh, yeah, that's cool, dude.
Yeah, so we would travel for months on end and trying to make it, I'm using air quotes, but trying to get something going on tour, even for a band like SNFU, it was really tough, you know, like we play like Sioux Falls and there's like 20 people there and then, you know what I mean? It's like, wow, what happened? And then, you know, we'd have our little pockets of fun. And I mean, I always remember, I mean, you're not from Chicago, but the Fireside Bowl.
Oh yeah.
Playing places like that. And, you know, I played in a band in the early 90s called Red Fisher based out of Winnipeg. And we played the Fireside Bowl the week after the guy inherited it from his dad.
Oh man, that's nuts.
So it was, and we played with Braid. Was like one of their first shows.
Yeah, yeah. Is Braid from, they have a Milwaukee connection. We're pretty close to Chicago, so I'm familiar with a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, you're like an hour and a half. Is Milwaukee about an hour and a half or 2 hours?
Depends on traffic. It can be anywhere from like 75 minutes to like 4 hours to get into Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah, Braid. Yeah, they were based in Chicago. I don't know if they have. I don't know what their Milwaukee connection is, but
I don't know. It's like we're close enough that we can kind of skip back and forth between the two.
Yeah,
It was like members of Fall Out Boy like lived up here in Milwaukee too for a little while, and Hey Mercedes was another one, I think.
Yeah, well, Hey Mercedes. So. There's members of Braid and Hey Mercedes, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Yep, okay. Yep. Yeah, yeah. I remember I tour managed a band called Voivod, and
dude, that kicks ass.
We did the Milwaukee Metal Fest.
At that ended up being at like the convention center or something.
It was
like
the
that,
late
'90s,
so it would have been. It was that hall. It had two levels, and it was a ballroom. God damn it!
Rave?
I can't remember what it was called, but I do know that Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment was right around the corner from there. So
you're definitely thinking of the Rave, and it wasn't Jeffrey Dahmer's apartment. You're thinking of the Ambassador Hotel, where he killed his second victim and then cut up the body in the hotel room and then brought it out in a suitcase, like a dripping suitcase.
Yeah.
He checked out at the reception desk and everything on his way down, and nobody asked him any questions. It's nuts.
Yeah,
I wrote an article about that for Vice a long time ago. And I went and had drinks at the bar. It's like a totally like remodeled nice hotel now. And they didn't level the entire floor, but they demolished all the walls and redid the floor plan so that his room wouldn't exist anymore.
Right.
So, that's a super fucked up story if you get really deep into Dahmer lore, dude. That shit is wild. And they talk about that at the rave all the time because it's supposedly haunted with like the ghosts of the people that he murdered and stuff like that. Like, it's a cool place. Did you see the abandoned pool in the basement while you were there?
No, but I saw on the same night I saw the Misfits and Gwar on two different stages on the same night. That was a trip, yeah, for sure. And but we did go around the corner to see where that place was, and it looked like it was either completely leveled or they were rebuilding it, but there was like holes in the fence where people were taking like pieces of the foundations out.
Then this wasn't what I'm thinking of then.
Yeah.
What venue would have been by? Because they did level his old apartment complex for that same reason.
I think was it the Eagles Ballroom, the Eagle Ballroom, the Eagles something?
Yeah, that's the rave that you're thinking of. And the Eagles Ballroom is like upstairs in the rave. Like the rave is a big complex. It used to be like an old, like a super, I don't know if it was a Pabst or somebody like that, but it was like a one gigantic mansion that like rich people used to hang out at all the time and stuff like that. And so there was an enormous ballroom on the top floor, and it was a gym. Sorry. Kate's my wife yelling.
It was a basketball court. Yeah, I remember the basketball court. Yes. And it had amazing acoustics. It was like we could record drums in here all day long. That's what I do remember about that place now. Yeah. Yeah,
drums are about all you can hear well in that room. Everything else is just like a wash of feedback.
Yeah. When I was there with SNFU, Cannibal Corpse was playing upstairs.
Yeah, I saw Slayer play there in the same way. It was just like an unintelligible, like just darkness coming from the stage. Loud darkness.
And I've told the story before, but when we went to go get paid, the promoter somebody actually told me the name of the promoter that worked, who ran that festival. I kept looking for him to get our money, and I'm like looking around going, okay, where is he? And he was always on a different floor. He was always hidden. So finally I get him. I go, hey man, we're leaving. Can we get paid? And he goes, sure, come out to the car. So I'm like, okay. So we're in the parking lot, and it's all the cash he has is in the trunk of his car. So he's like, what was I paying you? It was in the dark. You know, I'm like, whatever it was. He's like,
$1 million. Yeah. That's what I would have done. Yeah. And then you quit music for the rest of your life.
It was $800,000. And then he sort of peeled off the cash and sort of almost kind of threw it at me. Like, there you go. And I'm like, do you want me to sign for something? Like, this is, you know, I'm like a late or mid-20s tour manager guy. You know, I'm green as it comes. Yeah, and the guy's like, no, just get out of here. I'm like, okay, all right, cool. All right, I'm going.
Dude, for real.
Yeah, for sure. And so that's all I do know about Milwaukee. I think my band Red Fisher played one show there somewhere years ago. But there's a lot of, obviously a lot of cool stuff that happens in every little town, and the scenes are always sort of tight, and everybody has that scene, you know. And
like mutated cousin of Chicago is what I always say. it's like a weird, it's basically like a Dahmer version of Chicago. That's how you describe it. So I love Milwaukee, man. I'm born and bred here. I'm never gonna leave. I just think just the strangest stuff has happened here, and it's like I feel like it's interesting and comforting in the same kind of way. And everybody here has a chip on their shoulder and in like some kind of weird inferiority complex. And like the stereotype of the Midwestern city blue collar person is like stronger here than anywhere else. I think it's hilarious. I love it.
But the scene, how was the scene when you were coming up? Whenever you started?
Yeah, so I started setting shows up when I was 14, in basements out in the suburbs, like churches and stuff like that.
What sort of age? What sort of timeline was that, by the way?
What's that? What do you mean?
What years? Like, what year was that? Sort of.
Oh man, it would have been my freshman year of high school, like right away. So that was 1999, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
So there were a lot of it was like this weird kind of mathy. Like Albini worship kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. There was a guy named Shane Hochstetler who runs a studio here. He actually recorded drums for our last record. He played in a bunch of bands. There was one called Minagra, another called Hero of 100 Fights. He was just like the best drummer in town, and sort of like that was like the sound, you know, basically just like Shane playing drums. Mm-hmm. And then like a dozen other people that like would all form new bands and stuff like that. And I was riding into town to school because I lived out in a tiny little city called Oconomowoc growing up. And the guys that would drive me into school would play all this stuff on the radio while I was going in. And that was sort of my first exposure to, like, I guess, punk, quote unquote. I didn't know it was punk at the time. I just thought it was like, I was really into like Tool and nu metal and stuff like that, like every other middle schooler was at the time. And I just thought it was like a weird offshoot of that kind of. So I sort of started doing that. And my school started, we had like this open mic thing every year that one of our English teachers would set up. And they would just do this show in the cafeteria at my school. And I kind of got the idea around then, or somebody told me around then, like, you know, you can just do this like wherever you want. You just have to rent a hall, you know, or find a place with like, you know, tolerant parents or a tolerant priest or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you can set up your own show and you can do whatever you wanted. And so that's sort of when I started booking stuff. My band at the time was terrible. You know, we didn't write a whole lot of our own music. We tried to, it was very bad. And, but I mean, I think it's like a quote of Steve Jobs's where he says, like, it's a really powerful feeling when, you feel that license to be able to alter the environment around you, you know, and bring something to life, you know, that wasn't there before that you dreamed up. And that was really my first experience with that. You know, I would think of a cool show and then, you know, I just had to make a phone call and, save up a few weeks of allowance or something like that. And all of a sudden I had a party somewhere else and I didn't have to clean up the mess at the end of the night. And I could take $20 afterward and like go to Denny's with my friends and buy everybody sausage or some shit like that, you know? And that was for a teenage kid, like it was really inspiring and empowering, I guess, to put it that way. And, so I started doing it more and more. I'd set up shows at Legion Halls. And, by the time I got around to like, I was 18 or 19, I'd seen enough of these bands and seen a lot of them go on tour. And, it was the same thing. Somebody just told me, you know, you don't have to wait for an agent to come along. You don't have to wait for somebody to like pay your way or something. You can just set a tour up, just do it. And so that's, sorry, Kate's just wandering next room. And so that's what I did when I was 18. I set up a tour with the band that I was playing with at the time. And, I didn't have my parents like telling me that I had to be home by a certain time. I didn't have to clean up the mess. Met a whole lot of cool people everywhere I went and saw a lot of cool new places. And I think from then on, kind of, I was really hooked on it. Music was as much, it wasn't as much about art as it was just meeting new people and seeing new stuff. And, sort of being able to get an experience that it's, I think it's really difficult to do if you just travel and stay in hotels and stuff like that. Being able to sleep on people's floors and eat their food and talk about their problems. That's sort of always what I say. It was a really formative thing for me. It taught me a lot more about life and people and business and work and art than any other class in college did in a lot of ways. Just going out and doing that kind of stuff. It's been tremendously important to me.
Yeah. So, the experience is the most important part because it's not the money and the fact that you
definitely not the money.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
And when somebody wants to do something, like I find there's a sort of a common thread when I meet people who are in bands that started off independent, that they did it because they didn't want to sort of deal with other bullshit. They just wanted 100%. To just go do it and then either fail or win, because that was, you only had two choices and it was in your hands. It was your destiny to either fail or win at it, you know?
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
At least for me, it was just the fact that I was able to do it was a win for me. Mm-hmm. You know, it was nuts. We came home from this first tour and like none of my friends had ever like even considered the fact that somebody could do that, like let alone them, you know. Mm-hmm. It was really cool to come home and then all of a sudden see three other bands buddies of mine or something like that, who all of a sudden were like, dude, I'm booking my own tour tomorrow. And then they do it. We'd have stories to share and stuff like that. And, made for a lot of close relationships with people that I don't think that I would have had otherwise.
Yeah. When I first started in the early 90s, they had that Maximum Rock and Roll Book Your Own Fucking Life, which was that was so powerful because you just sort of call ahead and say, I'm coming through town, and they put you up and it's usually the punk house in whatever town you're in, like in Indiana or somewhere like that. And we would book our tours with it. and we would meet some of the craziest people, but we also had a lot of failures because the people we would come around to their house, we'd never just call them and say, hey, we'll be there tomorrow. We'd say, okay, we'll see you in 2 weeks. And then we'd show up and they'd be either kicked out or moved or forgot there was a show. And they'd be like, oh, okay. Yeah.
Always.
So there was a sense of like, just a sense of weirdness. Like we used to stay at this one place in Minneapolis called the THC House. And our friend Chad, who was in a band called Threadbare, would put us up every time we came through town. And it was in Minneapolis, just out, it wasn't St. Paul. It was Minneapolis. And that guy is still a friend of mine from this day. You know what I mean? And it was always, always cool to like go to the house and we would actually do the dishes. So the people liked us because
it's awesome.
Yeah.
You're much more courteous than most touring bands I put up.
Do you still put bands up? Is that sort of, is it still in you to sort of pay it forward, so to speak?
I do if people ask. It's always, it feels weird to me a lot of the time, like pushing people to stay at my place, because at this point we've dealt with enough people who are like very insistent that we stay with them, you know.
Yeah.
That's happened enough where that kind of freaks me out. And I don't want to do that to people. You know, when I have buddies in town or if it's a younger group or somebody that's played a dud show or something like that, I'll offer it up. I run my own club now too on the south side, and we have a vacant apartment upstairs that I put bands up sometimes too. And so I have another place to stash people. Kind of. But yeah, I mean, one of the big reasons why we bought the house that we did is because there's an extra apartment downstairs for people to stay in. It was a part of the reason why I wanted to move into this place to begin with. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I always try to, and, a lot of the time at this point, like if the shows that I'm booking are for my friends, are for groups that are doing well enough now that they'd much rather just have their own hotel room that they pay for and not have to deal with my bullshit in the morning, you know? I think I'm too old for a lot of the groups that really need sort of free places to stay. They don't want anything to do with me a lot of the time. So, younger kids now, they don't want to be hanging out with a 35-year-old man with a 3-year-old kid at home. So.
Yeah, no, I get it. I understand. But, you know, I did some touring in Europe, and it was a similar situation because we didn't have money, and hostels were always a place to stay. But in Europe, it's a little stronger and a little bit better.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah.
But we would stay at these houses, and it would be like, it was just crazy because you're like, what's going on here? And it's just like a whole, like in sort of Eastern Germany, it's a whole different mentality of person. You know, they're nothing like us at all. Yeah. Like they look like us and they like the same music, but they're nothing like us. They're just really intense and just like one lady sitting here and sort of captures my ear and starts talking about what it was like to live in sort of Soviet type times and how horrible it was and how mean everybody was. And I'm like, yeah, but you know, it doesn't, you know, you're trying to like always look on the bright side. And she's like, no, fuck you. And you're fucking, you know, and it's like, whoa, Jesus Christ, what are you doing? But it was always sort of intense trying to deal with.
The farther east you go in Europe, the more people have struggled and the more proud they are of their struggle, I think.
Yeah, and it gets intense because
people in the U.S. are embarrassed by their struggle a lot of the time. I've never really understood that. I think folks in Europe a lot of the time are not really romanticized, but they're much prouder of the stuff that they've weathered, you know?
Yeah.
I think Western culture is much the opposite. Where if somebody's struggling, it's like they feel like they're failing or they're looked down on or something like that, you know? Mm-hmm. Success is much more valuable over here than struggle, I think, which is too bad because most people struggle, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think if there was a sort of a different outlook and where people could be proud of like weathering bullshit, you know, rather than feeling bad that they went through it to begin with and now finally they're past it, you know? I think that everybody over here would be a lot happier than they are, honestly. But who am I to say? I'm not a shrink. I don't know.
Yeah, no, but it's you. But you have more perspective than most people because you get to meet different types of people, and you have a better understanding of humanity. You know, so because that,
I don't have a better understanding of it. I've just observed a lot wider range of it, I think. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I think everybody in the hospitality industry all has the exact same attitude, which is they're always positive all the time about everything, you know? Mm-hmm. And when you're in a house where like, there's six people there and the promoter's strung out and doesn't have enough money to buy like heroin or something or painkillers for the next day, and they're freaked out about that. You know, that's a much realer situation, I think, than why your room service is 15 minutes late or something. You know,
yeah, we stayed at a house in Indiana, and they were, it's this crazy house, all these BMXers, and the guy goes, "You, let's show them the experiment." And the guy's like, "No, man, we can't show them the experiment." He goes, "Yeah, no, we're going to show them the experiment." And so they bring this
lab, isn't it?
It's a jar, and it's like full of just brown, and you see like the tail of a rat, maybe some feet. And I go, what's in there? And you go, we don't know. We just, everybody sits there and throws stuff in it, and it's called the experiment.
Dude, that's so gross.
I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, and it's just sitting in the room. I go, has anybody opened the jar? And he goes, not in a long time, but it, you know, and they're just trying to.
Don't open that fucking jar. Like, guaranteed. There's some kind of gas that's at least built up in the air gap on top of it that nobody should be breathing.
That's true. And it's nasty. The guy that played in the band with us was a heavy BMXer, so we would always play wherever the BMX part was. Like, so there was a park like around the corner, so he would go ride BMX, and we'd be like staying with these fucking weirdos, and then we'd play the show in a house and then leave feeling very like, oh, that was, that was just, yeah, too punk for me.
Yeah. I don't know if there's any, I'm trying to think of a situation that was too punk for me. We skipped a house one time because it was, there was so much garbage that we couldn't load our equipment in. We decided that it wasn't worth trying to play that show. But I think that's probably like the worst of it, honestly.
Yeah.
I love that stuff, dude. Maybe it's for the stories.
Yeah.
We played at a place in my old band played at a place in, Hell's Kitchen in New York where, we got booked by a homeless guy who was just standing behind the bar trying to steal liquor, and like the phone rang and he picked it up, and I was 19 at the time, I think, and I was told to just call this bar, which I did, and this dude like picked up and he was like, "Hello," and I went, "Hey, is this Siberia?" And the guy behind the bar was like, "Yep," and I said, "I am calling to book a show on this date," and he went, "Sure, that sounds great." And I went, "Okay, so can we call that confirmed then?" And he went, "Yep, as far as I can tell." And we went, "Okay." And then we showed up, and that same dude was out front panhandling from people for change. And they had no idea that we were even showing up. You know, we showed up, and there was like something else going on in the basement. They let us play last minute. This dude like took us to his. He was like squatting in an abandoned warehouse floor, like two doors down from this club, which doesn't exist anymore. And, like we smoked weed with him that he just like pulled out of his pocket. He was living on like a pile of greasy rags and just had like weird stuff like surrounding him, you know, and he would get all of his booze by stealing from the bar downstairs. It was like, there were two people that paid the cover that night, and he tried to like get a cut of like the cover that night. The place had like one single red bulb on the inside of it to like light the entire room that the bar was in. you know, and that's, like, objectively a shitty show, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
There's no way in any way that that's considered like a good musical performance or booking. And it doesn't make any difference, dude. The story is just way too good. Yeah. There's no way that I ever would have, like, no regrets about it. I'm so glad that it happened that way. Really, the only time, like, I mean, we've never felt unsafe or actually, that's not true. We got locked in one time to a ham radio station in Italy because the promoter that put the show on was living in a squat, and the city was trying to drive them out because it was in southern Italy where the Vatican has, like, a really big influence, and they hate punk, you know? Mm-hmm. And so they locked us into their radio station where they broadcast a whole bunch of activist stuff about how the church is fucked, which it is.
Yeah.
And, but dude, people used to throw like Molotov cocktails like through their windows all the time to like try and burn them out of the building that they were in and stuff like that. And you know, even then, like I didn't sleep that night. I was real worried that something fucked up was going to happen. I'm still glad that we did it and made it through it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell people about it now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
you see something that you didn't know before, and you get to experience it.
Oh, totally. We played, we were on tour with the Weaker Thans, and we opened up for them in a northern Italy place, Squat. And we're playing, and it's just this weird vibe, and it's supposed to feel comfortable, or whatever. And then somebody looks, turns to us, and goes, "Hey, it's our anniversary." I'm like, "Well, what?" It's like, "It's been 5 years since the cops have raided the place."
Ah, it's like, awesome.
Oh, awesome, great. So what's gonna happen? Well, you should probably leave because it is the 5 year, and they've been threatening and things like that. And we're like, "Okay, we're getting out of here because we're supposed to stay there and just sort of sleep there." But we all like, "We're getting the fuck out of here. This is too much." Like. What?
Isn't it like the squatter law or something like that? Is if you can stay at a place for 10 years in Europe or something like that, that you like technically own the property that you've been living in or something?
I don't,
it's something crazy like that.
I don't know what how it all works, but I do know only Europe is a place where that kind of thing, and they are actually really organized. You know what I mean? Like it's super organized. Like there's someone making food, there's someone growing food, there's someone, you know what I mean? Like there's a sense of community that it's sort of like, hey, I guess it works. I guess it works.
it's ancient. I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, where I like you go to like Australia is like perfect example of, because that country's only been a country for like 2 years or something like that, you know. But like United States, even like it was in 1700 or something like that that people first started settling here beyond like Native American culture.
Yeah.
And dude, Europe, like there's fucking castles everywhere you go.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Like thousands of years old, and it's based on like this like legal system that's been around for thousands of years, and it came from a time that has nothing to do with today, but it still applies in weird ways.
It's genetic.
It's really interesting to see how that has played out.
Yeah.
Or to read about it, at least. It's not like I've lived in Europe for any like extended period of time, but yeah, it was a shock being over there.
It's a genetic thing. I've said this 1,000 times. I'll say it one more time. But the reason I think bands that are a little bit older in age are successful in Europe is because they didn't really have music and image-based TV. It didn't really exist. People like they didn't really have an MTV. They didn't really have that type of thing. And I always use the Scorpions as an example. I mean, look, those guys are probably playing the Ginoma Dome somewhere in Munich right now. You know what I mean? Like,
that's good.
So they have like this sort of, we don't care. There's no ageism, because there is a sense of ageism, because I couldn't get arrested in North America at the age of 33, but I could put records out in Europe and go on tour and people kind of like the band, you know? And that's a sense of, there's a sense of like, well, why and how? And there is a culture thing there for sure. And I think because they don't, you know, there was times where, I mean, I hear stories, it never happened to us, where people would come buy everything on the merch table. Like when NoFX would play somewhere in Germany, the people would buy their like a week's worth of salary, pay to buy everything on the merch table. And I don't think that really exists anymore because it's so global. Everything's so global. You can buy it online. But there was a sense of like passion for music that doesn't exist, I think, in North America.
Yeah. Well, have you ever heard of a guy named Marshall McLuhan before?
No.
So you should read this book. It's not really a book. I had to read it when I was in college, actually, but it was actually really interesting. And this guy named Marshall McLuhan is, he's a journalist and he's sort of a media theorist. And, he writes about the difference between hot and cool media. And, cool media is something that demands a great deal of engagement from an audience because it doesn't engage your senses like completely. Like you have to like imagine something, or you have to really think about it while you're doing it, you know, versus hot media, which provides everything for you all at once. You know, what you're talking about, I think, is a pretty good example of that, where a lot of the media that's consumed over in Europe has been and continues to be stuff like books or records. And it's not like you're saying MTV, where it's music and video and personalities talking at you, you know, like the whole time. And I think that's why it is that it's a lot more difficult to engage with people in the US, because they're fed stuff, you know, and they don't really have to work to consume whatever it is that they're consuming. It's just, it's handed to them on a silver spoon a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And so if you're into punk or something like that, where you can't really afford to figure out how to spew 8 different kinds of content at somebody at the same time and let them like vicariously pick in one way or another, I think your art is a lot more appreciated by people that generally consume cool media rather than hot media. And he writes about why that's a big part of the reason why it is that like education is so terrible in the US in a lot of ways, is because kids from a very young age are conditioned to only pay attention to stuff that doesn't require a lot of work or thought to be able to enjoy or to sort of, I don't know, appreciate in a lot of ways. And I think that's why it is that a lot of punk bands have such a great experience touring over in Europe, is because people actually put the work into listening to their stuff, you know, and trying to figure out what it's all about. And you don't get that a whole lot in Western culture.
Yeah, there's an appreciation of, first of all, you're getting on a plane and flying across a huge body of water to make the effort to go to their little town somewhere. And the other thing I've sort of come up with is that when we, like 400 years ago, we didn't have things like museums and even churches and things like a cultural center point where people would go and get fed culture. For the better part, that church is somewhat important in early beginnings of getting cultured and understanding, and whatever the intentions are, it doesn't matter, but there's still like, that's the focal point of where people get their knowledge, be it jaded and wrong. But the part that we didn't have over in this part of it 400 years ago, genetically speaking, was that. And I think that does key into it in some weird, deep, genetic muscle memory thing. Like maybe your lizard brain kind of understands something about what it is to, and for the better part, there's some really great people in North America. There's some really great people in Europe, but, and there's also some fucking assholes in Europe too. But if I might generalize, what my observation is that people do sort of, you know, want to get more into your band, and because you've traveled to get there, mostly. Because if a band comes from Europe and plays, like we had a band from France play with us in our city in Toronto, and people were sort of like nonchalant, I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? These guys have flown on a plane, they went through customs, they paid money to get here and play, and you fucking idiots, you're embarrassing me. You know what I mean? You're embarrassing us as a culture because they've taken the effort, you know, and the other part of this, any band from Italy or Europe, they say, well, I'm gonna come and play in Canada. I'm like, dude, stay there.
Dude, I love playing in Canada. Yeah. Are you kidding me? We played more in Canada this last year than I think we have in like probably the first, I don't know, how long have we been a band for? 2007? Mm-hmm. You know, first 10 years of existence. Like last 2 years, we've gone up and played Canada a lot, man.
Yeah.
There were so many cool bands coming out of Toronto for a while, like Pup, obviously, and Fucked Up. And Career Suicide, fucking Grays. Brutal Youth, like I never really like thought to go to Canada all that often, just because the idea of crossing a border seemed really scary.
Yeah,
you know?
And it is.
But dude, I mean, we flew out to Quebec City 2 weekends ago, I think, to play there. It was awesome.
Yeah,
super tight, dude. And so don't say that about your country.
I know.
These are so far apart.
Yeah, it's the distance.
It's a pain in the ass to drive 11 hours between Vancouver and Calgary.
Yeah.
And or drive up to like where the sun rises at 4 o'clock in the morning in Edmonton, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Grand Prairie. So,
what's that?
Grand Prairie. It's even worse up there. Cause it's like 11:30 at night and you're like, is it gonna get dark? Because I'm getting tired here.
Yeah, dude, wild. So I do want to play in Newfoundland someday. I'm gonna figure out a way to do it. I would love to go up there and see what that's like.
There is a place there called Merlin's, and I don't know if it's still there, but it was the oldest club or the oldest bar in Newfoundland. It's obviously you have to fly there or take a boat because it's an island. But we did this flight from Halifax, and it felt so Buddy Holly because it was snowing so hard, and we're like, we're going to go play this club. Well, first of all, the first flight got canceled, so we're like, oh, okay, so we're going tonight, right? Yeah, we're going tonight. And then we get to the airport and it's full snow bucketing. We're like, we're not going to get out of here. And they go, nope, we're leaving. So anyways, we get on the plane. I go, as long as it's not the plane with the prop, with the wing on top. And of course it's the one, okay, as long as it doesn't have propellers. Oh, it's a propeller with the wing on top plane. And then, so we get in there and just ironically in the radio they're playing is Highway to Hell by AC/DC. So we're like, oh shit, we're gonna die. Well, this is it. Like, goodbye, guys. We get up and I look out, and you know, the little strobe light, and all I see is snow. I'm like, then we're dead. Like, this is a 2-hour flight and it's low level. And it was like the scariest thing ever. But we got there. But there's also 6 feet of snow had fallen over the past 2 months at that point. There's, so don't go in the winter.
I'll keep that in mind, I think.
But yeah, you should actually to see, because that part of Canada is absolutely beautiful, like PEI. You should stay a while because there's it is a beautiful part of Canada for sure. Absolutely.
I gotta remember that.
Well, let's quickly plug, you're coming up to Canada to play the Blackout Fest.
Yep,
that's good. That's a super cool festival, by the way.
We've never gotten to play with Seaway before, dude. I've been hearing about that band because we did that split with Mixtapes, like I think our very first vinyl record I ever did a while ago, and they were buddies with them, I think, for a little while.
Yeah. And there's a band called the Antiqueens playing that, I think, that too, which are
I watched them at Pooza, dude. It was fucking awesome. Yeah. They rule.
They're amazing.
But, do you know what day they're playing by chance?
No, I don't, actually. But they're super cool. Good, nice people too. Like, and their manager is actually the guy who owns part of Pooza Fest, Matt.
Okay, cool.
Super cool guy. So anyways, thanks for doing the show, man.
Awesome. Thanks for talking to me, dude. I appreciate it.
That was Nick Woods from the band Direct Hit. Good songs, good band, good dudes. Hey, Wisconsin. I haven't been to Milwaukee in a long time, so it was fun talking about Milwaukee. Okay, I'm not doing that. That's stupid. I know it's a Wayne's World thing, okay? Get over it. Okay. Anyways, so everybody, thank you so much for tuning into the podcast week after week. It's always good seeing you back here. Come and, listen to old dudes talk about stuff. It's exciting. So next week, I do have episodes lined up. It's this week. Actually, next week. What am I going to tell you it is? Because it's a surprise. But I do know I have a couple of good ones, and one of my favorite ones is coming up. It's with the band Bracket. Old friends of mine from the Bay Area, I think. San Francisco-y. So, anyways, we'll see you next week. Okay, have a good one, and party on, Wayne.